And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. Michael Lauck will be joining us in a moment for the news. After the news, I'll be talking with Kevin Goodman of the UK, where we discuss the famous 10-year stretch of the Warminster UFO sightings. I have to use an English accent to say that properly. So, Michael, what's going on with the news today?
Oh, we have lots of news to cover. We have cattle mutilations and some science news. Lots of good stuff. But first, I'd like to remind everyone that we are broadcasting our shows every Friday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, which is minus 5 hours UTC, on the all1broadcast.com network. That is all the number one broadcast.com. And we hope to see you in the chat room. A Discovery Channel article explains cattle mutilations. Benjamin Radford covers a series of Missouri cattle mutilations in a recent Discovery News article and finally explains the mystery, albeit with the same explanations of parasites and predators that everyone uses. Unfortunately, he ignores the fact that the most recent corpse was actually surrounded by char marks, and they were probably not caused by wolves or maggots. You can read his explanation and view an interview with the rancher looking for answers from Kansas City's KSHB-TV through the links in our show notes.
Yeah, who is he anyway, the reincarnation of Philip Glass? I want to read this from this little excerpt from the article itself.
All right.
Carrion animals eat soft tissue of the body cavities first, the mouth, the tongue, the anus, the nose, the eyes, the teats. That's why those parts discovered missing in the animal, discovered dead after several days or weeks without knowing what killed the animal. It's impossible to determine the exact time of death. Most mysteriously killed animals are found within a few days, which is plenty of time for an animal's soft parts to be completely gone, unquote. So what I want to talk about is that is BS because, you know, there's so many cattle mutilations, which they found the cow the next morning.
You know, this is probably one of them, too. In his article, he does call this a remote Missouri ranch. I will point out that I was actually in this area on my vacation.
That's the kind of place you go on vacation for?
Well, no, but it's not. It's between the Lake of the Ozarks and Branson and Kansas City. And it's not huge cattle ranches. It's small family ranches, most of whom are run by people who have day jobs and have a few head of cattle. I don't think this is one of those operations where, you know, you go and check on your herd every couple of days, especially in the Missouri summer where it can be pretty hot and you want to keep an eye on your cattle. Chances are this woman only owns, you know, a couple dozen, three dozen head at most, and sees her cattle every single day. And I don't know that for sure, but that is the kind of farming that goes on in that area.
I'm in the middle of reading a great book that George Knapp wrote, and it's Hunt for Skinwalker. I really recommend the book, and hopefully we'll have George on in the next few weeks or so. The ranch was very, very remote, away from, I think, like 15 miles away from people. There were some reservations nearby. They kept very, very good track of their herd, every single animal, and they would see these weird spheres around the herd, and then next thing you know, the next day, they'd find one mutilated. No blood, no footprints. No one's claiming that they're aliens doing it, but there's something really weird happening, and it's certainly not, you know, kids coming out with surgical instruments, and, you know, there's never any blood found in any of them. Of course, that would explain the carrion animals, possibly, but still, you know, when they're found the next day with no blood and precise incisions and things, it's really a mystery.
Yeah, I agree. It is one of those things where it can sound very reasonable to explain it, but the more you look at it, the stranger it becomes.
Right, exactly. I think we should do a show on cattle mutilations. I'm going to try to find someone that really knows a lot about it. What do you think?
You know what? I think that's a great topic to turn over to the listeners. And if anyone has any suggestions for a nice, reasonable researcher on the topic, send them our way.
Sounds great. Yeah.
Space laser communications. Now that ground testing has been completed, it has been announced that a European Space Agency Observatory will test a laser communication system with the NASA Lunar Atmosphere and Dust Environment Explorer once it achieves lunar orbit in October. The new system is designed to allow for much faster downloads of large amounts of information, such as photographs from spacecraft.
You know, I was wondering about this, and, you know, you think of laser as kind of being harmful in a way. You know, you wonder, like, if a bird's flying over the laser. I mean, I may be picturing this whole thing incorrectly, but it just seems like it would be kind of a hazardous thing to project up into the sky.
No, you know, it's funny. My kids were watching The Big Bang Theory just last night, which is a show I hate, so I don't know who any of the characters are. But they were bouncing a laser off the moon as an experiment, and someone's dumb friend was like, you know, aren't you afraid you're going to blow up the moon? And the thing is, lasers by and large are fairly safe. I mean, weaponizing lasers has actually been very difficult. We've been trying for a while, and you know, we don't have like really great anti-aircraft lasers yet. Or, you know, the fighting robots with lasers that I'm waiting for, or any of that. Most lasers are really benign, and you probably have several in your house. If you have a video game system, a Blu-ray player, your computer, you know, I mean, every time you check out at the grocery store, you know, they use lasers to read those barcodes. So most lasers are pretty benign. The microwave systems used to move information between like cell towers or usually radio towers are actually probably more dangerous to birds, because those will occasionally cook a bird that lands in front of them.
Ouch.
And that's the science lesson for today.
Oh, good.
The search for alien spacecraft gets funding. Jeff Marcy, the scientist responsible for finding scores of exoplanets, is turning his attention to finding signs of alien civilizations. He is hoping that data already gathered by the Kepler telescope for planet hunting will actually have clues that reveal alien spacecraft or communications. The Templeton Foundation has now funded his search with a $200,000 grant. Marcy admits that he is not even sure how to proceed on his search, but given his track record in the field of planet hunting, he has a better chance than most.
Yeah, well, I'm sure he doesn't know how to proceed. I mean, we can only guess what technology advanced civilizations would be using anyway. And, you know, it's kind of like SETI might as well be looking for smoke signals. You know, I think about this, and it's good that something's happening. He's doing this. I don't see anything really that wrong with it. But there's never any funding for research and what is buzzing around in our skies. I think that's, I don't know if that'll ever happen.
I don't know either. I think part of the appeal of this is that he's using information we already have to go back and kind of fine comb for other things. One of the things he has mentioned that he might be looking for are some kind of signs of laser communications to tie everything back together. Giant celebrity magnet is UFO lookalike. While traveling from New York to the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory outside of Chicago, a giant electromagnet gained celebrity status, partially due to its flying saucer-like appearance. The magnet had a Twitter hashtag, the big move, fans seeking it out just to get photographs with it, and a page on the Fermi Labs website tracking the move. Of course, we have a link in our show notes to the story with pictures.
Yeah, I looked at the pictures, and, you know, this thing is shrink-wrapped. It's quite wide. You know, it suspiciously looks like the crash UFO in Roswell. Did you notice that? No.
It looks suspiciously like an accelerator magnet, too, though.
Okay.
But we've moved enough of these things that if you were going to move a giant spaceship now, maybe you can just say it's some part for something else.
That's my point exactly.
And now I think this is my favorite story of the week. Star Trek's Galileo shuttle in a NASA museum. The original shuttlecraft Galileo from TV Star Trek was unveiled July 31st to the public at NASA's Space Center Houston, the museum associated with the Johnson Space Center. The shuttle was not a model, but a full-size set piece used in the original Trek series episodes such as the Galileo 7. A fan purchased the prop in an auction and spearheaded the year-long effort to restore the shuttle. On hand to celebrate the installation of the shuttle were Robert Picardo of Star Trek Voyager and Stargate Atlantis, Sylvester McCoy of Doctor Who, and Gil Gerard of Buck Rogers, among other science fiction celebrities. Our show notes have a link not only to the Space Center Houston's page on the event, but also space.com coverage, which includes a great 10-minute documentary on the restoration of the Galileo.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. You know, I was at an auction house a few years ago in L.A. where they sold the carpet to the Enterprise at auction, and it went for $11,000. You know, so can you imagine what this thing must have sold for?
$61,000.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
And it was a piece of crap.
He did the total restoration.
It really did. I mean, it was built to be a set. It had been outside for years.
Uh-oh, better get Mako.
It was – well, you know, it's funny you mention that because actually it was a custom car place that built the shuttle.
Wow. Oh.
So there you go. And it was a boat restoring company that restored it. So wow. The documentary is really interesting. I will nerd out about Star Trek all day if given the opportunity. But it is kind of a cool documentary if anyone has the chance to watch it.
You know, I think I'd rather not know any of that and just pretend that it's all real. I think I'm getting a little delusional.
There's that too. This.
Yeah.
And now for the big story of the week, Art Bell returns to the airwaves. The near legendary Art Bell, the original host of Coast to Coast AM, has announced he will be returning to the microphone this September on Sirius XM satellite radio. His new show, Art Bell's Dark Matters, will run 10 p.m. to 1 a.m. Eastern Time, meaning it will not directly compete with his old show. He has stated, according to an AP article, that he is not a fan of current Coast host George Norrie because Norrie is not, quote-unquote, edgy enough. Well, Martin Art's back, so should we just throw in the towel or what?
No, I'm glad he's back. That's something he said about Norrie. As a matter of fact, you know, Peggy wanted to come on this week and rant on Norrie, and I said, no. Norrie lived in the same town as Michael, and Michael may not like that. You have good things to say about old George Norrie.
I loved his local show.
Okay, good. We can end it right there. Let's just end it right there. I'm friends with Art Bell on Facebook, but that's nothing special because he has about 4,000 friends. So I did send him a message and ask him if you know he'd be on the show for a couple of minutes to announce that he's coming back. Haven't heard back, probably won't, but it's always worth a shot trying to get someone like him on.
Well, here's my real question. He's Art Bell. He's got the, to use a buzzword from a few years ago, the gravitas in the field. But he's on XM radio. I mean, is he going to have the impact that he had before? Like him or not, Norrie's on 500-plus stations. I mean, I think he's the second biggest radio show in the world now and the biggest overnight radio show.
Right.
I think Rush Limbaugh is the only thing ahead of him.
Hmm.
You know, can XM radio compete with that?
Yeah. You know, people like Howard Stern, you know, major, major contracts. I understand why they move over to satellite radio. But it's funny. It seems like it's a tougher and tougher business to hang in there.
Yeah, I mean, do you have, you don't have to answer. Do you have Sirius?
No, I don't. I did for a little while because it was free for a year in my new car, you know, but that's it. Yeah, I don't have it now. And, you know, I got to be honest with you, I hardly ever listen to it anyway.
I have their music channels through my satellite television. And, you know, I guess it's supposed to hook me on it. What I learned is that there used to be three music stations I would listen to. Now there's only two. And my iPod puts both of them to shame, which is, you know, years ago at one point I looked and said, you know, am I going to buy satellite radio or an iPod? And I went with iPod and,
yeah.
and I've been really happy about it.
And that's how you found Podcast UFO, by the way.
Yeah, actually.
Right. Okay, Michael. So is that it for the news?
That is, but I'd like to take a second to remind everyone that this Sunday is the first Sunday of the month, and that means it will be the first of the Podcast UFO live call-in shows.
Oh, yes, on the allinonebroadcast.com.
That's right, at 8 p.m. Eastern time.
Yeah, so don't miss that. You can call right directly. We'll have a phone number up for that. We'll announce it during the first of the show, and you can call in. That'll be a lot of fun. And it's going to be just you and I this time for a whole hour. What the heck are we going to talk about?
I think we'll probably find something.
Maybe about UFOs, possibly?
Maybe. Maybe we'll do cattle mutilations.
Oh, we have to do some in-depth research quick then. So you noticed in the first part of this show that we have a new intro, and we also have a new outro, and that is a composition written for this show by Kerry Whitehouse. We have another composition of his coming up between the news here and Kevin Goodman. But I wanted to thank Kerry very much for making us that piece of music. We kind of rambled a little bit today, didn't we?
I think we've done worse.
Maybe, yeah. All right, well, we'll catch you next week.
All right, have a good show.
Thanks.
Thanks. How are you?
Good. And where am I Skyping you at exactly?
Well, you're Skyping me actually in a town called Stourbridge, which is about 12 miles west of Birmingham in the Midlands of England. I've been born and bred here. I moved away for a few years and moved back about 3 years ago, back to the old homeland. Hmm. And now here I am.
Were you in Warminster at one time?
Oh, I've never lived in the town. I've always wanted to. But I was a regular visitor from 1976 through to the early 80s and then dropped out of ufology for personal reasons. You know, you grow up, you find, you know, you marry, you find better things to do with your time. And then due to personal circumstances, I rediscovered my mojo, as they say, as Austin Powers would say, for the subject in 2003 after my wife died.
So you've been back right at it ever since 2003?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, you know, somebody was to say to me, come down to Warminster tomorrow, I'll be there.
Well, you know, since I think about the last year, I've had emails and someone just posted on the forum recently that they wanted to have you on as a guest. So, alas, here you are.
Alas, indeed. Yes. I just only hope I can live up to the expectations that people have put in me.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, I'm sure you will. Now, can you talk about... It was not exactly a UFO wave, but there was something going on in the Warminster area during the 60s and 70s. Can you fill in the listening audience exactly what was happening?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, research that I've done into Warminster over the last 6, 7, 8 years or so has taught me a number of things, in so much that although... We have a saying over here in the UK, and I don't know if you have it over there in the States, is where there's smoke, there's fire. Although Warminster has had a lot of detractors over the last 10 or 15 years due to the sheer amount of sightings of UFOs and anomalous objects that were in the area, I saw things in that town which, you know, even now, as a seasoned sky watcher stroke researcher, I find very, very difficult to rationally explain away. Now, to give you a brief history of the Warmminster phenomenon, it actually started on Christmas Eve of 1964 when a Warmminster housewife was walking to Christmas service at Christ Church, where, according to Arthur Shuttlewood, she was assailed by sonic forces which knocked her to the ground, leaving her jelly-legged, shocked, and just generally sort of bemused about the whole thing. Now, it's also been reported that around the same time, other people within the town heard heard the same sort of thing. For example, Roger Rump, who was then the chief postmaster of Warmminster, reported that every 5,000 tiles on the roof of his house, it sounded like they'd been lifted off and then just dropped down. And, you know, you have skeptics, and skeptics say, well, how does this man know there were 5,000 tiles on his roof? Simple answer. He just had it re-roofed.
Oh, you mean you have skeptics over there too?
Oh, good God, do we have skeptics or do we have skeptics? Yeah, I mean, I'm always battling against those people that say, oh, Warmminster never happened, or, you know, Warmminster was blown out of all proportion. But unfortunately, it's the nature of the beast to a degree.
Now, I understand later on there was actually things seen in the sky. Were they, the things that were seen in the sky, were they ever accompanied with this sonic phenomenon?
No, I don't think as such, no. The visual manifestation, for want of a better word, started around May of 1965, about 6 months after the sonic sound started. I would suggest that your listeners try and track down some of the books by Arthur Shuttlewood, who wrote 6 books in total about the Warmminster phenomenon, to get further details. But, for example, somebody, I think it was on the central car park in the town, was looking over towards the direction of Cop Heap. Now, Cop Heap is reputed to be an ancient burial ground where an Anglo-Saxon chieftain was buried. And there were 2 red-hot pokers in the sky which seemed to stretch and burst asunder without sound and then sort of fly away. So that was the start of what was known as the visual phenomenon in Warmminster.
Now, this event that took place on Christmas Eve in 1964, besides the 2 accounts there, had everyone in the town basically experienced this?
Well, Warmminster at that time was a very quiet market town in England. And we are talking now nearly 50 years ago. And UFOs were not generally known by the general public. It was a very sort of very small, very cliquey, almost, well, I don't like to use the word geeky, subject.
Well, geeky's in these days, so you can say that.
Oh, that's okay. In that case, that makes me A1. but the local populace, because they hadn't had exposure to the UFO phenomenon as such, referred to the Warmminster phenomenon as the thing.
Right. I read that, and I like that. You know, there was a movie called that, but it was a whole different subject, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I think that was, 1950s horror film that was redone in the 80s, but that is beside the point. So you have this quiet rural town that is suddenly being bombarded by these strange phenomenon. And the local populace were absolutely bemused by this. You know, they had no idea of what it was. And such was the interest in the town that on the August bank holiday of 1965, the local town council actually called an extraordinary meeting where people from BUFORA, the British UFO Research Association, among them John Cleary Baker, were invited to talk to allay public fears that Warmminster was about to be invaded or that there was an invasion from space due on Earth.
Hmm. So they called your thing the thing?
Yeah.
And it progressed forward from there?
It progressed forward. The problem was, Martin, that it was self-sustaining to a degree. For example, there was a photograph taken by a young factory worker by the name of Gordon Faulkner, which it's become the iconic photograph of the Warminster Thing, which is of a low-flying UFO. Now, the problem with that photograph is that the negatives have been lost over the years, and when it was actually published in one of our major newspapers over here, the Daily Mirror, and they run a centre page spread about the whole the Warminster Thing, it was enlarged so much that the individual grains of emulsion on the negative were clearly visible. And the problem with that photograph is that it gives no sense of scale, no sense of distance or anything else. So the photograph itself is worthless. But on saying that, if it was a hoax, and I'm not saying it was, and I'm not saying it wasn't, it was a very cleverly put together piece of photography.
Now, is that image available on your website?
I think it is. I mean, I haven't been on the website for a while because my co-author and good friend Steve Dewey actually sort of manages the website. I just sort of throw the odd pieces of information at him and they're put up. But then again, if anybody is interested, if they just type in Warminster UFO, Warminster Thing into Google Images or whatever, the photograph itself will probably come up.
Okay.
We also have a Facebook page if anybody wants to join it. If they just go into Facebook and just type in UFO or Warminster, it should take them to it as well. But I will say that the Facebook page is more of a, well, with Facebook itself, it's more of a social thing. And we do sort of, to a degree, take the proverbial out of ourselves slightly. But it's still a good repository for any information.
Can you tell us how long the events kept happening there?
Well, as I said earlier, it was self-sustaining to an effect, because after the Daily Mirror article, people flocked to the town. And bearing in mind that Warminster, it was and still is to a degree, a very small market town, it is the only time around the August bank holiday period of 1965 that the pubs in that town ran dry. There were that many people. And bearing in mind that Warminster also has School of Land Warfare, which basically trains a lot of the infantry for the British Army. So it's a garrison town, and for the pubs to run dry, that is one hell of an amazing thing to happen.
And when all these people flocked to that area, were sightings happening?
Sightings were happening. You know, there's no two ways about it. But again, you know, I have a slight theory about all of this, in that Warminster happened at not a crucial time in society, but it was the dawning of what was then known as the Age of Aquarius. It was the start of the burgeoning hippie movement. Consciousnesses were changing from going from, shall we say, traditional religion to, you know, the youth of the day wanted to look outwards rather than spiritually inwards. And people would go to the town, see something, they'd go away, tell their friends, their friends would think, oh, you know, that's interesting, we'll go. They'll go there, see something, go back, tell their friends, and the whole thing was almost self-sustaining for nearly 15 years. I mean, the whole thing really petered out at around the end of the 1970s.
That sounds like a Woodstock or something.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Woodstock, I think, is a very good analogy to use, in the fact is that the Rolling Stones gave a concert at Longleat House, which is not very far from Warminster at all, and it's rumoured that they actually went up onto the hill to skywatch.
Has that ever been confirmed, or is that just hearsay?
It's not been confirmed. It's hearsay, but there does seem to be a great deal, well, not to say a great deal, but people have sort of said, yes, I remember that happening.
Wow. And, you know, probably skipping ahead really quite far, but what's going on there today?
Very little, I'm afraid. Warminster is about as ufology active as any major town in the UK or the US. But on saying that, the area that I live in now, some of your listeners may have heard of something called the Dudley Dorito. Yeah, it does make you smile, doesn't it?
That's better than the thing. Yeah, true.
I mean, Dudley is one of the major towns in this area, and a black triangular-shaped UFO has been seen over the area for about the last 10 or 15 years on a semi-regular basis. Now, you know, being a researcher and being moderately well respected by not only my peers but by those who study ufology, I've had a number of people say to me, oh, you know, it's secret military technology, they're testing it. Well, all I'll say to that is, why on earth are you testing it over one of the most densely populated areas of the United Kingdom?
Well, not only that, I mean, I always find it hard to believe about these big black triangles that you hear about over and over again. Could we really have that type of technology that something could be, you know, like a football field wide and hover silently and move slowly over? That's what everyone says they basically do.
Yeah.
Could we really have that technology and not know about it?
I don't know is the honest answer. Now, funnily enough, that leads me into that leads quite nicely into a sighting that I had in Warminster during the Easter period of 1977. Now, I took part in a UK TV program a few years ago called Britain's Closest Encounters. And in episode 2, it was dealing mainly with the South Wales sightings from 1977 to 79. But they decided to shoehorn a little bit in about Warminster because, again, going off topic slightly, this shows just how much Warminster has been forgotten. Hmm. That I was contacted. They wanted to talk to somebody by the name of Peter Paget, who was based in Warminster at the time, who I knew and still know. He'd written 2 books, UFO UK and a book called The Welsh Triangle. And I said, well, you know, I'm very sorry. At that time, I didn't have a contact address for Peter. But I said, well, will you be doing anything about Warminster? And they went, Warminster, what happened there? So I filled them in. And then I got an invite to go up onto Cradle Hill in Warminster to film a slight insert for the program, which I did. And they digitally recreated this sighting I'm about to tell you about. As I said, it was in Easter of 1977. My friend and I, Colin Rees, were walking down from the infamous Cops area at the top of Cradle Hill. And over from our right, where there is a golf club on the hill next to Cradle Hill, came 4 red lights. And they were just flashing. And they were equally distantly spaced apart. They flew over the aforementioned cop heap, which I mentioned earlier on, and stationed themselves in a horizontal line over another hill in the area called Battlesbury, which again is supposed to be an Iron Age fort. These objects just stayed in the line and flashed intermittently for about a minute or so. Then the extreme left-hand object, the leader, for want of a better word, shot off horizontally at speed, did a flawless 90-degree turn upwards and shot out of sight. Now, this was in 1977. The height of military technology, aviation-wise in those days, was the Phantom Jet. Anything that could perform that kind of manoeuvre, if it had been manned, the crew would have been turned to strawberry jelly.
Absolutely.
Right. Now, the other 3 lights, which stayed in the line, then about 30 seconds, a minute or so later, then just shot straight up into the sky. To that day, I still can't explain that sighting.
Now, you said this happened in 1977. Is that what got, that must have been the initiative that got you started in this field?
Well, it wasn't the initiative, actually, that got me started. I mean, I'd been a regular visitor. I mean, I think that was about my 5th or 6th visit to Warminster.
Oh.
And that was the, apart from what you could class as satellite transits that went over, you know, that was the first genuine anomalous sighting that I'd had. And we just stood at the bottom of that slope, at what was known as the White Gates area of Cradle Hill. We just stood there, open-jawed, slack-mouthed. We just couldn't believe what we'd seen.
Absolutely. Now, were there other witnesses that you're aware of?
The only witnesses that we had was a young girl who was with us, who was the daughter of the lady we were staying with at the time, and she knew very little or nothing at all about the Warminster phenomenon. And again, she was like us, you know, what have I just seen? Now, to give you an idea of the weather conditions that night, it was twilight. You know, the sun had gone down. It was getting dark. The first few stars were starting to come out. It was a moonless night, very still, no wind. sound traveled a great distance in so much that we could hear trains going through the station, which was about a mile away, quite clearly. And whatever these objects were, Martin, they did not make a sound.
That's something you hear over and over again, and that with my own sighting, I had the same thing happen. And I wasn't familiar with that whole spectrum of UFOs, that there was no sounds. I was kind of relieved when I heard other people say the same thing. Now, as far as Colin Reese and that other lady, did Colin pursue any type of UFO research himself, or that the young lady as well?
No, the young lady didn't. I mean, Colin and I were very good friends. We still are to this day. He is still exceedingly interested in the subject. But, you know, what could you do in the 1970s as regards actually investigating a sighting like that? Very little. Don't forget, this was a time before there were no mobile phones. You know, again, cutting-edge technology was a cassette recorder.
Right.
You know, Polaroid cameras. There was nothing that we could actually physically record this sighting with. We went back to Peter Padgett's research center in Warminster called the Fountain Center, reported the sighting, and Peter did one or two investigations with some contacts in the military. They said there were no events happening at that time. And again, jumping forward in time, I've been contacted by a number of members of the armed forces who were based in the Warminster area during that period, and they would say that they were out on what we call over here stag duty, which is like guard duty, and to alleviate boredom, you know, they would themselves would skywatch, and some of these troops actually reported seeing things which they couldn't explain, which again, there were no activities, no military maneuvers happening at the time. So, like I say, smoke and fire.
Mm-hmm. It's funny, you hear about, I guess you'd call this a hotspot or something like that. You hear about this happening where, for instance, the Belgian Triangle, where something's very active for, say, a period of time, maybe a year or two, or in your case, maybe up to 10 years, something like that. And then it vanishes. But, you know, I recently got to meet Wilfred de Brouwer and spoke with him, and he says that things are happening in Belgium and that whole area right today. It's just not reported as much. So this phenomenon that happened there could re-spark someday. That's a possibility, wouldn't you think?
I think it's a definite possibility. I mean, just off the top of my head, I can think of, obviously, Warminster in this country is probably, if not in the world, the longest sustained UFO flap. You have the South Wales sightings, you have Banbury, you have the Pennine Corridor, you have Bonnybridge. So, you know, it seems as, almost as if these window areas, these slide zones, whatever you want to call them, they tend to shift. Mm-hmm. Almost, you know, and I'm not saying that, you know, it's just to say that, you know, you've got little green men leaning out going, cooey, we're here. It's, you know, it just seems that, you know, whether or not Warminster itself, I mean, Arthur Shuttlewood, bless his memory, you know, he said that he'd heard that Warminster was over the 13 ley lines converged over the town. Now, again, your listeners may know about ley lines. They may not. You know, it's another avenue of research to look into. Ley lines basically are ancient trackways, pathways, lines which, shall we say, ancient sites are aligned and a straight line is drawn.
Oh, yes.
I mean, again, for example, Warminster is very close to Stonehenge, Avebury, West Kennet, Silbury Hill and Glastonbury. The whole area is known as the Wessex Triangle.
Okay, now, speaking of Stonehenge, in your research that you've done, has anyone actually seen sightings around Stonehenge?
Yeah, people have reported sightings around Stonehenge. And the interesting thing as well is that when the Warminster phenomenon started to die down in the late 1970s, should we say the early 1980s, suddenly, there was a rash of a new phenomenon around that area, which we now know as crop circles.
That's right. I remember hearing about them being not too far away from Stonehenge, and one was fairly close, if I remember right.
Yeah, I mean, there was one which I think was a hoax, but whoever, you know, construct these crop circles, you know, they have to be congratulated. I mean, there was one. There is a hill just outside Warminster called Clay Hill, which is directly opposite the entrance to the famous Longleat Estate, and there was a geometrical 3D, almost like Rubik's Cube style crop circle actually created at the foot of Clay Hill. Now, Clay Hill, apart from Cradle Hill, is probably the most second famous sky-watching location in the Warminster area.
I just recently heard Nancy Talbot speak. She's going to be a future guest. She has BLT Research, was originally funded by Lawrence Rockefeller, and she's trying to do scientific research. And I listened to her at a symposium, and she was absolutely fascinating. Because I've always been on the fence about crop circles and, you know, no answers really, but more questions after listening to her.
I think the problem with crop circles, ufology in general, is that no matter how much you research it, there are still more questions that end up needing answering.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, again, I would love to have a, you know, a proper scientific investigation made into the entire UFO phenomenon, be it in this country, in the United States, worldwide. But who, as a serious scientist, wants to put their name to that type of research? It's still regarded as a very fringe, shall we say, science.
Yes. Or they call it pseudoscience, if they want to.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, again, you know, I mean, I was actively involved in ufology. Well, I am more so now than I was in the 70s, but I left it in about 1983. And as I said to you before, I didn't get back to it until about 2003. But the one thing I will say now, whether this is down to television programs like The X-Files, I do not know. But ufology now seems to be, in this country at least, a much more accepted interest than it ever was before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you still have people, you know, sort of make the glib comments about, oh, do you wear a tinfoil hat, mm-hmm. and all this sort of thing. But people now don't dismiss it. It's more, you know, it will start a topic of conversation rather than just being, oh, you're a bit of a nutter, aren't you?
Absolutely. I've seen a big change that can only open more doors, I think.
I think it will open more doors. I mean, whether or not, you know, I mean, humanity itself as a species is starting to go through some kind of spiritual sea change, I don't know. But it's become more socially acceptable. And as I said earlier on, you tend now to actually engage people in conversation about it, and people are genuinely interested. Whereas before it was, you know, sort of, oh, yeah, okay, right, fine, well, let's change the subject.
Exactly. Besides Warminster, are you doing other research?
Well, no, I mean, I must admit, Warminster really is my sort of focal point, in so much that I've been there, I've been touched by it. Right. And, you know, and sadly, we are, as I said, we are talking about events initially that happened 50 years ago. A lot of the people that were there at the time are no longer with us. So it is now, shall we say, the second generation of researchers, witnesses, whatever you want to call us, who are now carrying the fire forward. And we're trying to now bring it to the attention of hopefully a third generation who will then carry everything on. I mean, Warminster, the people in the town seem very reluctant to talk about what happened in the 70s, those of those that know about it. Very few people in that town do know what happened in the 1960s.
Wow. Now, have you ever, in your research, have you ever gone through microfiche for looking at old newspapers?
Yeah, there is a small museum in Warminster called the Dewey Museum, no relation to Steve Dewey, I hasten to add, where a researcher, who sadly is no longer with us, by the name of Ken Rogers, bequeathed all of his paperwork. And there are box files of books, newspaper clippings, information, handwritten, jotted documents. And I stayed down in Warminster for 3 or 4 days, and I actually got permission from the museum to take these box files out, and I actually scanned them into my computer, and I've still got a lot of the paperwork. And the curator actually said, "It's a pity you don't live in this town, you know." And I said, "Well, why is that?" And he said, "Well, we really need somebody who knows about the subject to index this all and actually do us a proper inventory." So there is information there. But the sad thing about the Dewey Museum collection is as well that someone a few years ago actually managed to loan out 2 whole box files of clippings which were never, ever returned. Hmm. You know, so where they went to, nobody knows.
The MOD.
I don't think so. Yeah, we are getting into very sticky water there, aren't we, really, to be honest with you. But, you know, these files have gone missing. That we don't think they'll ever be returned, sadly. What they contained, no one knows.
Were you looking through them prior to that, or had they disappeared before?
That was after they disappeared, unfortunately. Somebody obviously got there before I did, sadly.
I see. I just touched on, you know, the government. Did the government do any research at all that you're aware of and what was going on?
Well, not that I'm aware of, but of course, a lot of your listeners will be aware that the British government have been releasing a lot of their files on ufology over the last few years, mm-hmm. Thanks to Dr. David Clark, who seems to have been the person who's been pushing forward for all this. And every time we get these files released, I download them. And of course, I'm always looking for basically Warminster or the local area related documents. But of course, because of the Freedom of Information Act and the everything else like that, a lot of the relevant information that you need is blanked out, like names, addresses, and sometimes even locations. So the MOD file downloads, really, all it is showing is that people did report UFO sightings to the Ministry of Defence, but as a research tool, they're useless.
Going back to the 1960s and 70s, we were talking earlier about the lack of cell phone and the internet and all that. What would someone do to report a sighting there?
In the 60s, probably they would have contacted Arthur Shuttlewood, who became the champion of the Warminster phenomenon. Arthur was, it depends on what you read and where you read it and what you believe. He claimed to be the editor of the local newspaper, the Warminster Journal, but we do believe actually he was more of a features writer. Arthur was a journalist, as I say, and he was the person who started to amass all these reports. And he claimed to be a hard-headed, realistic journalist until he saw the phenomenon for himself, which apparently he did. And then he became from, shall we say, a moderate skeptic to a believer. Hmm. And these 6 books, starting in 1967 with the Warminster Mystery through to, I think it was 1979 with UFO Magic in Motion, these books chronicled the sort of evolution of the Warminster phenomenon.
One thing really does change a skeptic's mind is when they actually witness something.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, as I say, I mean, I would say, as going back to that sighting in Easter of 1977, I was never a skeptic. I always wanted to believe, as we all want to believe in something. And when we saw those 4 red lights, you know, that was it. You know, I suddenly realized that my time and, you know, what money in those days I had not been wasted, because suddenly I'd actually seen this thing for myself.
Oh, going back to your sighting, had anyone ever reported a similar sighting there to that?
Oh, many, many times. I mean, it may not be the 4 red lights, but Arthur Shuttlewood, with, shall we say, typical English journalistic prose, referred to that type of sighting, that type of light, as the Amber Gambler. And I can actually tell you of another, although I didn't actually see this one myself, I wasn't involved at this particular sighting, but some friends of mine were. There was another area near Warminster, a small village called Upton Scudamore, which was a favoured sky watching location. And these friends of mine and I, these friends of mine, went out there one night, and there were four of them, and they decided to do a sort of shift pattern sighting watch. Two would kip in the car, two would watch. And about midnight, two of my friends were in the car trying to get some sleep. There was a banging on the window, and the door opened, and they said, come and have a look at this, come and have a look at this. And, you know, they all piled out the car, slightly bleary-eyed, and coming over them and then changing direction literally over the car was one of these amber lights, and it was quite low, you know. So, you know, as I say, things were seen in the area which still rationally can't be explained away.
Right. Now, you have a book, Cradle of Contact, which is about this. We'll talk about that, but I just wanted to say I love the names of the locations you have over there. Some fun names.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, well, it is typically rural England, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, Upton Scudamore, it rolls off the tongue.
I love it.
You know, Cradle Hill. I mean, I'll tell you a little story about the book. I started the book originally in 1983 when she was my fiance then. We went on holiday and I started work on the book. And I ran out of steam, you know, about 40 pages in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, over the years, I'd forgotten all about it. And sadly, my wife died, as I say, in 2003. And we'd just moved house. And there were still lots of boxes in the garage. And I started to unpack them and decided what to throw away and what to keep. And at the bottom of one of these boxes was the yellowing manuscript of this book I'd started in 83, which I thought I'd thrown out. And, you know, this over here particularly is a typical male thing. A lot of men seem to do their serious reading in the smallest room of the house. And I remember sitting down, reading this manuscript, thinking, by God, I could do better than this now. And so, you know, I started work on it again. And again, this is with the advent of modern technology, the internet. And I started to do Google searches for Warminster and Warminster UFO sightings. And I came across a web page by a gentleman called Steve Dewey. And it was entitled Warminster Deconstructed, because Steve is a skeptic. And that's why Steve and I work actually quite well as a working partnership.
Wow.
And I thought, that name rings a bell. So I emailed this chap and I said, are you the Steve Dewey I met at Peter Paget's Star House in October of 1976? And sure as hell it was. So that's the genesis of how the book actually happened. But the interesting thing was, you know, the book had been written and I was racking myself for a title. And somebody suggested UFO Warminster, which I thought, yeah, okay, that's okay, but it does need a subtitle. It's a bit naff, mm-hmm. You know, just UFO Warminster. And I'm not going to give too much away, but if anybody wants to get a copy of the book, please do and read it. I could do with the money, you know. You know.
And where would they find the book? Is it on your website?
It's available on Amazon, hopefully. They can get it either Amazon.com or Amazon.co.uk. It's actually now, the book was privately published to start with, and I had, I think, nearly 1,000 copies or just about 1,000 copies printed, and it sold out within 18 months. And this is me just pushing the book myself, doing all my own self-publicity.
I see.
And then about 2 years ago, I was invited to speak down at the Weird Weekender in Devon, run by John Downs of the Cryptozoology Foundation. And John said, look, I'll publish your book. I'll republish it. Don't worry about it. And so consequently, the book has been sort of, should we say, slightly updated, and it's now available via that medium. But as I said, you know, I was thinking Cradle of UFO Warminster, it needs a byline. And of course, Cradle, as in Cradle Hill, came to mind. And then again, without giving too much away, and the third word is the imperative one here, I suddenly thought, Cradle of Contact. That'll do.
Okay. Well, hey, I'll put your book beside your podcast on, so when people listen to the podcast, come to my website, they can find it and just click on and it'll go right to Amazon.
Thanks. And, you know, I mean, I always am available to answer questions via email if anybody wants to contact me. You know, I'm quite happy to do that. I mean, you know, some days it, you know, it might take me a bit longer to do it because, you know, about 2 hours a night these days is taken up by me just doing all this sort of stuff.
Oh, I hear you there.
But it's a labor of love. It's great to get the word out there because I think, and I'm not talking about Warmminster in particular here, people who have been genuinely touched by this phenomenon, you know, we need to get the word out there. We need to not make people exactly believe us, but we've got to get rid of this idea that we are not cranks.
That's right.
You know, I hate using that word. You know, it's a very 70s word now. You know, it's a very esoteric subject, this. But more people, as time go on, are prepared to embrace it. And that's the important thing. It's getting the word out there.
Whenever I heard Stephen Hawking say UFOs are only seen by cranks or something like that, that was quite offensive after seeing one myself.
Well, it rubs me up, you know, really badly, that. And, you know, I mean, I've got to say that, I mean, I've done two or three UK broadcasts now. The Britain's Closest Encounters was a great one to do. And we have over here in the UK a program called, of all things, Flog It, which is about antiques, of all things.
Oh.
And they actually did one of these programs from Warmminster. And it's a BBC production. And they asked me to do a little bit to camera. Because what happens with the initial broadcast of this program, it lasts in the UK without advert breaks, as I know you have in the States, 45 minutes. And for about 10 minutes in the middle, there is always a little bit about the history of the town where they're at, you know, be it, you know, Stourbridge, Warmminster, you know, wherever, Manchester. And I did a piece to camera and I was expecting it to be really taken with a pinch of salt. But again, these people took it exceedingly seriously, which is a sea change from what it was like in the 1970s.
That's right. So it's been great speaking with you today, Kevin.
Thank you very much, Martin. I really appreciate it. And I'm sorry it's taken me so long to get round to doing it with you.
Not at all. Again, if someone wants to see your website, it's ufo-warmminster.co.uk. Thanks a lot and take care.
Thanks, Martin. Appreciate it. Take care now.